Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, no matter how contrary that might seem, just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and it's so good to have you with me as I welcome back two good friends of the show. Later, you'll hear about my first sea foraging trip with medical herbalist Karen Brines-McLean, near where I live in Scotland. It was a chilly day, and I think we're all wondering what's happened to spring, as this April was quite a bit colder than we might have expected here in the UK. But have you ever wondered how temperature, both hot and cold, affects our health? Professor James Goodwin, a regular guest on the show and Director of Science and Research Impact at the Brain Health Network, was keen to explain just how impactful temperature can be. He's one of the world's foremost experts on brain health and the author of Supercharge Your Brain. I put it to him that most of us are unaware of how temperature affects our health.
Yes, JJ, you're absolutely right. The relationship between ourselves and nature is fundamental to our health. And probably the most important parts of nature is the temperature around us. We are tropical animals and we have a tropical physiology. And you've heard me say this before on your show. Because of our evolution, you can't untoast what's toasted. So no matter how far north humans migrated out of Africa, which was our evolutionary home, there are very few adaptations in our body to cold weather. How humans have coped with it is by behavior, clothing, and building shelter. And now, of course, you find humans everywhere, North Pole, South Pole, and everywhere in between, but everywhere we've gone, once you get outside those tropical temperatures, you have to make adjustments because of the effects it has on us. I'll just finish this opening sentence by saying one of the biggest features of that is we've got a regulator inside our brains or a thermostat inside our brains for heat, but we haven't got one for cold because it was never important.
That's interesting.
A large proportion of the 1.5 million years of our evolution, 300,000 years for true humans, being in the tropics, we never needed anything in the brain to tell us when it's cold. But the health of the brain was so important in those hot tropical climes that nature saw fit to put a thermostat inside our brain to tell us when the brain is getting too hot, not so for cold. And that is why once we move into cold environments outside the tropics, our health is at risk. And that's because we live in an artificial environment, warm homes. Well, maybe not so warm these days, but warm homes, shelter, warm, dry clothing and all the rest of it. We never think about cold too much. But I can go into why it's so important as we go on through the interview.
Yeah, no, I'm fascinated to know more about this because this isn't flippant, but I've often wondered why, if we live in a colder temperatures, we haven't actually developed more fur to keep us warm. But is that, I mean, do you think that's an evolutionary glitch, or do you think it's just because we've compensated because we have, you know, the mental capacity to create clothing for ourselves to keep us warm?
It's purposeful. In other words, as you move north into colder weather, there's less sun. And if there's less sun, you need more skin to capture the electromagnetic radiation to give you vitamin D. That is largely the reason why getting enough vitamin D was more important than fur as you moved north. It was for humans anyway. In the same way that dark skin evolved into lighter skin as we moved north, it was a vitamin D adaptation.
Right.
And it didn't change our fundamental human nature. It just meant that we survived. It just meant that we stayed alive because we had that vitamin D. So that's the reason for that.
Okay. Yeah. So we needed more skin to absorb more vitamin D. So, yeah. So we weren't going to cover it up with hair.
And that biochemistry, which fuels our physiology, I'm using sophisticated terms now, but is vitally important. And again, as humans, we don't seem to realize, you know, there are millions of chemical reactions going on in our body moment by moment. And any one of them goes, any pathway of those goes wrong, then you're subject to an illness. Now, as humans moved north, they could only do so because the climate changed. It actually paradoxically became warmer around the world, and therefore were able to move north into cooler climes, which were now warm enough to be hospitable to us. Now, that happened about 10,000-11,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago at the most, in Neolithic times. Now, what the climate change people will never tell you is that we're still in an ice age. Did you know that, JJ?
I did, yes, I did, but I don't think it's talked about much.
No, it's not talked about much. When I was at university and I graduated in the early 1970s, I remember the first question on my final exam paper was discuss the coming ice age. And we actually are already in an ice age. It's called the Quaternary period. And within any ice age, the glacial and interglacial periods. So in these ice ages, 85% of the time we're covered in ice, glacial, 15% of the time we're not. And we're in one of those 15% of the times now. But it's coming to an end because most of these interglacial periods are only about 12,000 years. So we're thinning out on a bit on it now. In fact, there is a finding that we're just going into a grand solar minimum where the amount of solar activity falling on the Earth declines markedly, and that's set to occur between 2020 and 2053, when weather may become as cold as it was in the Maunder period. The Maunder minimum was 1645 to 1710, when Scotland froze solid and the River Thames sold.
Yeah,
and froze over in London.
Yeah, people were skating on the Thames, weren't they?
They most of the year they lived on it, and in the summer there wasn't enough heat to grow crops. So there is there have been some scientific findings which again are not talked about. Grand solar minimum, people won't admit that we might be going into a cold period. But back to our point about temperature and health, humans moved north because the Earth was warming up, and it became warm enough to be hospitable. So they moved out of it, and as a result of that, they would encounter in a really cold climate. So once you got into Northwest Europe, ill effects in the winter on their health. Now, we've made a science out of that in modern times. It was a very cold winter in Britain in the 1960s. I think it was 1962 or thereabouts, where enormous numbers of people throughout Britain were admitted to hospital because of the effects of the cold and died. And the newspapers reported that this was due to hypothermia. It took 30 to 40 years, maybe longer, 50 years to dispel that myth. What people were dying of was heart attacks and stroke in the winter and respiratory disease. So it's about 32% of all casualties due to the cold in England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, British Isles, back to the British Isles. Just over 30% is due to myocardial infarction, heart attacks, thrombotic strokes, strokes caused by blood clotting, and about 27% respiratory illness. And those numbers have been huge. 10 years before that really cold winter, there were 110,000 winter deaths in Britain. Enormous. Now, since the 1950s, the number of people dying in the winter compared to the rest of the year has fallen. There have been some ripples in that. It goes up and down depending on the winter. So all winters are not the same temperature, of course. Dying as a result rises and falls as a result of the temperatures. I mean, I can just give you some figures. The winter of 2021-22 was fairly mild winter, and there's only about 13,000 excess winter deaths. 2012-13, it was almost three times that, 31,000. 1998-99, 50,000
wow
deaths. JJ, I'm expecting in October this year, when they publish the winter figures, that the winter that we've just come out of, I'm expecting between 40 and 50,000 excess winter deaths.
Gosh.
Number one, it was a colder winter than usual. The average temperature December through March was about 3 degrees. The average winter temperature in Britain is about 4.5. So we were 1.5 degrees colder. That's the first reason. Second reason, people cut back on their heating because the electric power grid wasn't up to it, and prices have had to go up for one reason or another. I don't want to go into that because that's politics and I steer away from it. But I don't believe that people heated their homes. I may be wrong, but I don't believe people heated their homes anywhere near like they do. Now, the extent of your risk in the winter depends upon your total exposure to temperature over 24 hours for the duration of those 4 months, December to the end of March. And people who are poor, low income, living in poor housing, living alone and who are old, are more vulnerable. Well, let me tell you something. The winter cold doesn't care whether you're rich or poor. It'll kill you just the same. So if you're going out and about with jeans and a T-shirt on in the winter, and of course, I've been into the famous English northern cities on Saturday nights when the young ladies are out in their gownless straps and the guys are out in their jeans and wet T-shirt, right, walking through Newcastle. God bless Newcastle, I have to say, but walking through Newcastle in the freezing temperature and often the rain, drinking beer. Right. Now, those are habits that we have throughout Britain because we get ambushed by the cold. And even in the winter, you can have mild days. So if you're in a cold home and then you're going outside into the cold as well, you're in big trouble. And it works like this. When you step out into the cold, the nervous system, in order to save its body heat, cuts down all the blood flow to the skin. So all the blood piles into the heart, right? And your blood pressure goes up massively. Now, the brain thinks, whoa, hold on a moment. Heart rate's up a bit now. Because all this blood's coming back to the heart's got to work hard to pump it out again. So the heart rate goes up, and then the nervous system drives it down. So you've got this anomaly in the winter. When you go out into the cold, your blood pressure goes up and your heart rate goes down. Unless, JJ, and you fall into cold water, then you have the privilege of both. You have your blood pressure go up and your heart rate go up. At the same time, because of the shifts in the blood flow and the effects of cold on the red cells, it becomes sticky, risk of blood clotting goes up. That is why in the winter you get this enormous increase in heart attacks and stroke.
What we hear is that people are dying of hypothermia in the winter. But what you're saying is it's not. It's all these strokes and heart attacks that are being categorized as hypothermia.
Yeah. Now, depending on your age and on your circumstances, your body will be colder in the winter than in the summer.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've measured this over three winters in older people. And what I found was their body temperature was actually up to maybe half a degree, maybe some cases a degree colder than it would have been in the summer. So body temperatures do go down. And when they go down, they raise the activity of what we call the sympathetic nervous system, which shuts down all the blood vessels. So that works together. But deaths recorded as from hypothermia are actually quite low.
Right.
To be hypothermic, which is very difficult to measure. So how a GP or a hospital doctor would know it's hypothermia, I don't know, because measuring body temperature is an art in itself, science in fact. But it's difficult to measure accurately. And it has to go down by 1.5 degrees Celsius central. So your central body temperature, core body temperature. Now, that's a lot of heat to be lost. To get your big body down by a degree and a half in the middle,
you'll have to lose
a lot of heat. And the other effects, the blood pressure and the heart rate and the coagulation of the blood, they happen far, far more easily and earlier than does your falling core temperature.
Wow. So temperature really is hugely important. And I guess, you know, if we're thinking about it logically, why do doctors take your temperature?
Yeah. The doctors can't measure body temperature very well. The infrared readings in the ear are a guide. They're a guide. So if you measure it in the same person from one time to the next, it's okay. The other side of the coin is respiratory illness. So as you breathe in cold air by going outside, it chills down the airways, depresses the immune system, gives rise to infection in the airways. So especially with a cold as well, or with COVID. Well, a cold is a COVID virus. But with any COVID infections, plus the cold going down and battering the immune system in the lungs, and there's about, I would say, 20% of the body's immune system is in the lungs. It's a big immune system, but you can paralyze it by breathing in cold air. So the longer you stay out breathing in cold air, the bigger the effect it's having on you, especially if you're over 65. And that's why the other third, just less than a third, about 27% of deaths in the winter are from bronchitis and so on.
That's why.
I'll tell you the really big killer. If you get a blast of cold air on your hands, feet, or face, even though you're wearing warm clothing, right, that can put your blood pressure up, drive your heart rate down, and make your blood sticky.
Wow.
I know. Trigeminal nerve that serves the face. I've done that in experiments. I've blown air at 20 degrees Celsius, moving air over people's faces and tested it. So
fascinating. And while you're digesting that bit of information, let's take a short break to hear these messages from our sponsors. Back with more right after this.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my guest, Professor James Goodwin, with more mind-boggling facts about how temperature can affect us.
Now, when is cold cold? Do you know when these harmful effects start in the body?
No, tell us.
12 degrees Celsius. How do I know? Because I've measured it. I've done the experiments in proper climatic chambers in big institutions like the Institute of Naval Medicine down in Alverstoke in Portsmouth. I've measured it. 12 degrees Celsius. So, you know, people think 12 degrees Celsius, 15. You can just about detect some change at 15, but it really starts increasing your risk of ill health at 12 degrees Celsius. Now, come on, in Scotland, it's not cold until it's 1 degree, is it?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I consider that to be quite warm, really.
Yeah, most people do, but those we're tropical. Remember, we're tropical animals. So that cold air in the airways and on the face or on the hands or feet, right? Whoa, the body goes, oh my goodness me, it's unbearable. So it starts to protect the body. The internal temperature of the body is about 37. If you've got clothes on, a couple of layers of clothes, you know, blouse and a top or a shirt and a woolly pulley, something like that, the temperature of your skin will be about 31. On your wrist or your hand, at the end of a long arm, it'll get down to about 25. So when we talk about 12 degrees, it's a big thermal gradient between your body surfaces and the outside air. And it's the bigger that gradient, the more the heat loss, the bigger the body reacts, the bigger the risks are to your health. Now, these risks to your health start at 12 degrees Celsius. And that's a big risk if you're 65 and over, but not a big risk if you're 65 and under. It's age related and temperature related. But let me give you some figures about really cold weather and really hot weather. The climate change people will tell you, oh, it's all about heat. No, it's not all about heat. I gave you some figures of between about 13,000 and about 50,000 for deaths in the cold, deaths in the heat. Most we've ever had is 2,500. For example, heat-related deaths in 2020 were about 1,100. That was it. Compare that to 30,000.
Yeah, people make such a big play out of the heat
Project
being
fear.
A killer.
Mm. Absolute project fear, right? The London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine said between, it's a 20-year period almost.
Yeah.
Between 2000 and 2019, there were 800 excess deaths due to heat and 60,500 due to cold.
Wow.
Now, I tell you this, right? If you look at all the government websites, it's the world we're all getting hotter story.
Mm.
The narrative is all about global warming and global heating. And it doesn't stack up. So one of the things they say is, oh, by 2050, heat-related deaths will be up to 7,000. Well, my counter to that will be, well, how about the winter of 2022-23 when we got 50,000 excess cold winter deaths?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? And then another one they throw in is, oh, well, over 6 in 10 adults think rising temperatures will affect them by 2030. Well, people's perceptions are not what's actually measurable reality. And then maybe they've all been frightened to death and thinking that we're all going to boil alive because of climate change and heat. And we're not. It's cold in our country, in the United Kingdom, and in Northwest Europe, right? All reputable scientific data shows that the effects of cold, even now, are far greater than the effects of heat. And I will stand on a stack of Bibles and swear to that. I don't have to. I'll stand on a stack of peer-reviewed papers.
Mm.
So if you put it in terms of percentage, let's take something like cardiac health. Or deaths by cardiac disease, your risk of death in the heat is up by 12%. Okay. Your risk of death in the cold is up by nearly 40%.
Yeah.
Cold is the killer. For a start, right, the human body is well designed to deal with heat. I'm not talking about being stupid and lying on, you know, Bondi Beach until you're burned into a crisp. I'm not talking about that. But generally speaking, you know, out of direct sunlight for long periods of time in warm temperatures, we are good at coping with heat and we are terrible at coping with cold.
Yeah, I have to admit that I do cope with heat very well, much to some of my friends' amazement, because they think that as a Scot, I shouldn't be able to. But I'm very happy in warm climates of very high temperatures. I'm also happy in cold temperatures, but I do compensate very heavily, you know.
Yeah.
You've got thermal clothing, you've got, you know, warm clothing that really keeps you toasty.
And to go back to the social problems caused by heat and cold, people over the age of 65 progressively come at very high risk to exposure to heat and cold, but more to cold than heat for the reason which I've just described. So over the age of 85, you're double the risk of dying in either heat or cold than you are at less than 64. These are just age-related changes within the body, mainly to do with temperature regulation. So we need to look after all vulnerable people. That's people who are on low incomes, people who have got lots of illnesses, and usually older people, what we call comorbidity, older people themselves as an age difference over the age of 64, 65. It all matters. And we don't do ourselves any favour in Britain because we tend to get, unless we're snowed in 6 feet deep, and that's not happening very often these days, we tend to go out in the cold, wearing not much more than we do in the summer. How many people, all the listeners, raise your hand, how many of you have got a winter wardrobe and a summer wardrobe? Well, my son and his family live in New Hampshire, and I can tell you for certain they do.
Mm.
They have a winter wardrobe and a summer wardrobe. We go out in the same flimsy clothes all the year round. And going out into the cold, right, is a bad idea if you're not protected enough.
Well, I have to tell you that I also have a winter wardrobe and a summer wardrobe.
You do.
And I make sure that my winter clothes are accessible. And I would say that the summer wardrobe doesn't come out as much or for as long a period as the winter wardrobe, because I do make sure that I stay warm. Yeah, but I know we were talking earlier about people in northern towns like Newcastle being quite gung-ho when it comes to weather. That's fine, I guess, or better when you're young, but as an older person, you can't do that.
You're at extreme risk.
Mm.
Where I see it is in the big cities in England. Actually, I'm not widely travelled enough in the winter in Scotland to know if this is the case, but in Bristol, in London, in Norwich, Birmingham, Manchester, all these places, you see the people in the same clothes all year round.
I think that's because when you're in a city, you are often going from place to place on public transport or in your car, or, you know, you're not really being exposed to cold for that long a time. I know when I lived in London, I might not have had quite the same wardrobe as I do here. Now, that's not to say that I'm muffled up in animal skins and goodness knows what, you know, to go through the snow, because we don't have that much snow here either where I live. But I wouldn't have that much of a difference in my wardrobe in London, because you go into a shop, it's centrally heated. You go onto the tube, the underground, it's warm.
You're right.
Everywhere's warm.
You're right.
So it's not quite the same. And of course, the temperature in London's always a couple of degrees higher than anywhere else anyway, because of all the people and the, you know, the heating that's in the buildings, and that raises the general temperature. So I think that's partly why.
It is partly why. As a caveat, I'd say 12 degrees Celsius is the level at which harmful effects to the human body begin.
Yeah.
So you are completely right about people go from warm environment to warm environment, but stepping out into the cold at 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, all of those temperatures, which we still do get, can still pose a risk to health.
Yeah.
I also tend to think that older people are not out and about in London in the same extent as younger people. Many of them are retired, or that they've, you know, they've made their money or haven't, as the case may be, and then they're at home anyway. So that's why indoor heating is so important.
Yes. So just as a final thought, then, how do we look after our more vulnerable people in society who might be susceptible to the cold? What is it that we should be doing?
That's a great question. At Loughborough University, we did a study where we talked to older people about what they thought would be reasonable to be asked to do. It was a great research project. We found from the scientific literature and the evidence what were the factors that would put older people at risk in the winter. Then we worked out a list of things to do from 1 to 15. I think it was more than that, but a long list of things to do. And then we got a panel of older people together. There were about 30 people on this panel. And we said to them, which of these do you think it would be reasonable to be asked to do? And out of that 15, 5. We couldn't be asked to do the other 10.
Right. Okay.
But right. Once we explained to them why they needed to do those 15, they began to change their mind. So they didn't understand that it wasn't hypothermia.
Mm.
They didn't know that they were at risk from heart attacks and stroke in the winter. Most people still don't. But the media largely do say that now. And I can take some credit for that, because when I was at Age UK, I spent 12 years with their PR department talking to the media about it to try and change public knowledge. So I think informing people about what the risks are is really important. I never get righteous, and I never start to preach to people about what they should do this way or that way about their health. The moment you do that, you know, you're the nanny state, you're condescending, you're patronizing. Just respect people's intelligence and talk to ordinary people and say, these are the risks and this is what you should be doing.
Yeah.
But you've got to make conditions easier as well. So all the measures, social measures, like benefits and home insulation and everything else that governments all across the United Kingdom are rolling out are to be applauded, because anything we can do to keep older people involved, not just older people, but children as well.
Vulnerable people.
Pregnant ladies, young people, older people, those with multiple disease conditions, those who've got disabilities or all vulnerabilities, they need those conditions in place.
Yeah.
And we also need energy security. And I think over the last 50 years, I don't think that many people would disagree. We haven't given much thought for energy security. We've just taken it for granted. So we just had a terrible winter where they were about to start firing up coal power stations in order to maintain their energy security. Nobody had thought it through very well. If we get colder winters over the next 10 to 20 years, as we might expect from the grand solar minimum, then we're going to be in trouble if we don't look after our energy security. It's all about a civilized country doing sensible things to keep people warm and not chancing it, because the rewards of chancing it are people dying and more in the cold than in the heat.
Well, certainly it's been an eye-opener for me to hear about how different the two extremes of temperature can be in terms of health. And thank you so much for talking to us about it. As ever, some brilliant information. Thank you very, very much. And food for thought. Here's to a nice summer, I hope. Hopefully we'll just have some lovely weather.
Yes.
Still a bit cold at the moment, but hopefully it will get better. But for now, hopefully you'll come back on the show again another time and talk some more about health. But for now, thank you so, so much.
It's a pleasure, JJ. Always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Professor James Goodwin there, a veritable fountain of knowledge, and I always learn so much from him. Time for another break right now, though, back with something different right after this from our sponsors.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Good,
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio, with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist. And talking about the relationship between us and nature, we turn to the great outdoors now. Foraging is a great way to reconnect with the world around us, and it's something medical herbalist Keren Brines-McLean does whenever she can. She took me out on a sea foraging trip the other day, and it was a bit cold and windy, but what a great experience to be out amongst the rock pools at low tide on the Fife coast, and what a haul of nutrient-rich seaweed or sea vegetables we gathered.
Right, well, Keren, we've just been doing some foraging, and we've been foraging down here on the coast for seaweed, and it's been great fun. It's been a bit slippery in the rock pools there, and the tide's coming in now, so we've retreated to a bench by the sand.
Yeah, and I've just slipped my wellies off because, of course...
You got wet.
I got wet.
You did get wet.
First 3 steps into the rock pool and discovered that there was a hole in the welly boots, which is why my daughter doesn't wear those boots anymore and why they were kicking around and I could use them. So anyway.
But we're not bothered about that really, are we? We did get a bit wet and it was raining as well. Now, the sun's just come out, which is lovely.
It's gorgeous. Yeah.
But, it was great foraging. It's just so interesting, isn't it, that we can get so much food on our doorstep. And let's just talk about what we managed to collect. And of course, we were doing it sustainably. We weren't uprooting the seaweed, the plants from the rocks and that sort of thing. But we got so many different kinds just in the space of a couple of hours. So we got sea lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
And we got sea spaghetti.
Absolutely. Sea spaghetti. We've got quite a good bag of sea spaghetti, actually. Yep. No dulse.
No dulse.
Dulse is the one that was on my hit list. And we didn't find any dulse at all, which is a disappointment. But we can come back at another time and look for it at another period. Although this is the peak time of year to be harvesting seaweeds. You want to get out into the low spring tides. And I think yesterday was the lowest spring tide of the year, or lowest tide of the year, I think.
Right, right.
And quite a low tide today. So you need to be getting right out onto the margins. And we found that, didn't we, when we were walking out. We thought, there's nothing here, there's not much seaweed about. And then when we got right out onto the margin with the sea, that's when we started to find a lot more of the seaweeds.
Yeah, we did. We did indeed. And it's also very important to say that you don't just take everything.
No. You need to leave some behind. You need to snip with scissors. You don't want to pull them off the rocks. And you want to make sure that you're not taking absolutely everything, because it has to be done sustainably. It's really important that, you know, we look after our environment. And no matter what you're foraging, you shouldn't go chomping off and taking everything that you find. But yeah, it's something that our ancestors would have done. And I think for me, that's the real draw for doing something like this. I mean, you were commenting when I was doing it, scrambling around in the rocks, how happy I was.
You were.
And I was just totally in the moment, you know. And I talk to a lot of clients about foraging, not necessarily because of food, foraging for their mental health, you know.
Yeah.
I think that going foraging actually gives us a brilliant dopamine fix. It really helps to get us in the present moment. It's a mindful activity, and so foraging, I think, is something that we should be doing, not just to put some food on our table, but to connect with nature. I think that's very important.
I think you're right, and connecting with nature and connecting with the sea all around us as well, because we live here in the UK, we're surrounded by sea. And it's just really important to keep that connection going. So we were very mindful of the tides, for instance, mm-hmm. when we were out there today. Now, some of the rocks that we were on are just about to get covered right now, I'm seeing. And certainly the sand that we walked across between 2 sets of rocks is now covered with water.
It's coming very quickly.
It does come in very quickly. You have to be mindful of that as well. So safety concerns are very, very important.
Absolutely. I mean, I would go foraging in woodland by myself or in fields by myself, but on the coastal margin, always take someone with you. It's just too easy to slip on one of those rocks. And, you know, I took a couple of slips.
Yeah, well, we both did. But luckily I didn't land on my backside or anything like that, and didn't hurt myself, and neither did you. But it's easily done. And if you go on your own, there's nobody to help you.
Absolutely.
Very often.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So go with somebody. But let's talk about some of the stuff that we got. Let's talk about the sea lettuce for a start. We saw lots of that and you were very happy collecting some of that.
Yeah, I've never seen so much sea lettuce in one place, and it's just such an amazing, vibrant green plant. So, or green seaweeds, very different from other seaweeds. You know, they tend to all to be sort of brown seaweeds, black seaweeds, green, purple. But sea lettuce looks the same colour as an iceberg lettuce.
It does look like a lettuce, yeah.
And you can eat it straight from the rock pool. I mean, I've had a bit of a munch out there. I know we've got a picnic for afterwards, but I've had a fair old fill of other seaweeds while we've been harvesting.
Well,
but
we both have. I've been tasting them as well.
So sea lettuce is, it makes a really nice sea salad as such. So, you know, some of the seaweeds, you wouldn't want to eat them raw in a salad, but that is one of the ones that you can just munch away on. Makes a nice salad. It's brilliant in stir fries. Or the other thing that you can do is dehydrate it, and then you've got a lovely green powder that you can use. You know, if you were having a sushi, you could sprinkle a little bit of your green powder in your sushi for the health benefits, but also because it looks really nice as well. And you know, I think that's the real thing to think about with the seaweeds is the health benefits, the minerals that you get from them are just incredible.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, not to be scared of picking. I mean, obviously be sure that you're identifying it correctly. But you were saying to me that there weren't actually any seaweeds on the British coast that are in themselves poisonous.
That's
or bad
right.
to eat.
Yeah, yeah. So some of them are tough to eat, but there's none of them that are going to kill you. Yeah. But some of them are probably pretty indigestible. But you can use them for making stocks, etc. So we got some kombu. Kombu, you couldn't eat it. You'd be chomping away on it, and you
tough.
Know it's pretty indigestible. Mm. But I use kombu when I'm making stocks, and I think you do the same thing. You're quite into bone broth, aren't you?
Yeah.
I always add a little bit of a seaweed into homemade stocks. So I use it. You know, if I'm having a roast chicken, I'll use the chicken bones. Throw some seaweed in there. I also have a bag of vegetable peelings I always keep in my freezer. So all my broccoli stalks and vegetable peels and bits and bobs, I chuck them in a freezer bag, and then when I'm making my stock, I just chuck all my peelings in.
That's so good. That's
such a good way of not wasting your food.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so yeah, the kombu. Now you can buy kombu, and you can buy a lot of these seaweeds, like the dulse, which we didn't find in the shops these days, quite commonly.
Mm.
But it is great to get your own. But there were other things that I tasted today for the first ever time.
Yeah, pepper dulse.
Mm.
Yeah, pepper dulse is it's a much smaller seaweed than regular dulse, and it grew like a moss almost across the rocks, didn't it?
Yeah.
But that's got a lovely peppery flavour.
Lovely.
Yeah,
I loved it.
Yeah. And then the sea spaghetti.
Mm.
Yeah. We were so funny. We were so busy looking in the rock pools.
Yeah, we didn't notice the sea spaghetti lying all around us. Yeah.
Lying on. And, you know, to see the sea, so we saw it in its three different stages. So the small little green bubbles of the young sea spaghetti, and then it produces these discs, and then out of the discs comes the sea spaghetti.
Yeah.
When I dry that, so that was quite green looking. When I dry that, that's going to go quite black. But it's a fantastic food to have in your cupboard. You can actually cook it just like spaghetti. And you could do a dish where you have half sea spaghetti, half pasta. So you're actually reducing the amount of carbohydrate that you're having.
Yeah.
And again, think about the amount of nutrition you're going to get from eating a seaweed compared to eating something that's made from wheat. You know, it's just packed full of all those trace minerals and nutrients. And I think it is something that we should all be thinking about. I think there's a lot of focus now on, you know, what we're getting from our foods and the quality of the soil. And a lot of our foods are really depleted in minerals. They probably have as much vitamin as they've always had, but the trace minerals aren't there because our soils are depleted. And so eating seaweeds is a way of really boosting up your trace minerals and getting those essential minerals on board.
Well, we probably had quite a few minerals on board today.
Yeah,
after tasting some of them, and some of them we didn't know the names of, but we tasted them anyway just to see if they were any good.
And some of them were like, one of them was like lobster.
Yeah,
it was incredible.
Yeah.
Really nice.
It was beautiful, that one. Yeah. And I still don't know what that one was called.
No, we need to investigate that one afterwards. It wasn't in my book that I had of the main seaweeds that you can forage, but I felt quite comfortable having a munch on it. So yeah, it's a really great source of vital nutrition, and one that our ancestors used, you know. And in days gone by, when we were living as hunter-gatherers, you know, in the early parts of the year, there were no green vegetables. You know, they would be coming down to the seashore and eating seaweeds off the seashore and picking shellfish, etc. So this was a really important source of food for people back then. Yeah, so we'd move out towards the sea in the spring and then back inland, you know, as the seasons developed. Yeah,
and it's important as well to remember that the sea around here, particularly where we are right now, is clean.
Yes.
It's not polluted.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I was quite happy to come around here. I've been at a talk with the East Nook Salt Company, and I've been asking questions then about, because they have to check their salt for pollutants, and they were saying they don't get microplastics on this part of the coast.
No.
And I think, you know, for me, that's really, really important. We're not getting microplastics. It's really clean.
Mm-hmm.
So great, come and get seaweeds, but you have to be really careful. There's areas where you just wouldn't want to be picking them.
No, absolutely. Mm. And you can judge the quality of the water around the coast as well by what marine life you see in the rock pools as well. Mm-hmm. And we saw, I was glad to say, a lot of sea anemones in the rock pools.
Yeah.
And I took some video of some of the things that we found. I'll be putting that together for a YouTube video. But it's good to see those little squidgy balls of jelly when the tide goes out, because they don't have their tentacles out. But that's a lovely thing to see.
Yeah,
because you know then that it's clean, right?
It's like if you're you know, our river near us, we have a heron that is on the river. So I know, because the heron's there, there's fish in the water, there's ducks there. Well, if there's animals around, then it's usually a good indicator that it's a fairly clean source.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we saw herons as well today. Mm-hmm. We've got herons and eider ducks and all the usual seabirds. There were some oyster catchers just down there where the tide's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it is good to see the abundant wildlife around while you're out here foraging. And like you say, you know, mental health-wise, that's also part of it, isn't it? It's getting out into nature and just absorbing what's happening around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been talking to a lot of clients in clinic, and I have to say, life in herbal clinic is very, very different now compared to when I started 20 odd years ago. And over the past year, the mental health problems and emotional issues that people are bringing to clinic is predominant. That's what we're mainly working on at the moment. And a lot of people coming in talking about neurodiversity, ADHD, ADD, really on the radar for a lot of people. And I think we're becoming much more aware of it. But I also think it's becoming more noticeable within our society, because we're not living with the land. We're living in this sort of computerized, fast-paced, high-tech society where we're working indoors. And actually, people need to get out and interact with the land. When they were working on farms, mining, fishing and whatever else, I don't think these problems were coming to the foreground, because we were connecting with nature in that sort of, you know, simple way. And so one of the things that I'm discussing with a lot of my clients is not just using herbal medicine, not just eating well, but actually getting out and foraging to try and bring them into that present moment, empty their minds. And you pointed out, when I was on the rocks, I looked really happy. I was completely empty-headed when I was doing that. I was just right in the moment, harvesting my seaweeds. And that's just blissful, to be in that place of just having a really, really quiet, empty mind.
Yeah, and I agree. And I just love, you can hear that gull going over.
Mm.
I just love just being out in nature. I just love being by the sea. I love just seeing all the seabirds around us. It's fantastic for your mental health. I think.
Yeah. And it's something, if you think, it's 3 years since the pandemic, you know, when we went into that first lockdown, and everyone was, you know, well, actually, I can't say that. Not everyone didn't have the same opportunities. I think for people that were living in more rural areas, not in the cities, there was a real reconnect with nature, and people started to really appreciate what they had on their doorstep. And we seem to have lost that. We've moved away from that. People aren't out walking and taking, because that's all they could do, you know.
Yeah.
They're not doing that anymore. And I think it's a real shame that people had that reconnection, and we've seemed to have slipped away from that and gone back to, you know, being back in the fast lane again. Yeah. Need to slow down. It's important.
Yeah, and come out and do a bit of foraging. And so what I want to ask you is, what are you going to do with all this seaweed that we've just foraged?
Well, I'm going to divvy it out with you, JJ.
Thank you.
But I'm going to take it home. It's going to have to be washed to get all the sand out of it. Washed and washed and washed. And then it's going to go in my dehydrator. So I'll dehydrate some, and then when it's dried, I'll give you some of the dried stuff as well. Lovely. To put in your store cupboard. Yeah, yeah. So great. It's a great way to preserve food. I've got lots of dehydrated stuff on the go. I've got wild garlic fermenting at the moment in the kitchen. My husband described it. I've got wild garlic leaves fermenting on the windowsill and wild garlic buds salted in the fridge. And he described it as a fabulous smell of garlic, or a fabulous smell of garlic in the house. I went, "You really like it?" He went, "I don't dislike it." I went, "Okay,
yeah.
Fabulous smell." But yeah, I'm going to dehydrate the wild garlic. If you dehydrate wild garlic without fermenting it, it doesn't have much flavour. If you ferment it, it really is packed full of flavour. And I always put wild garlic and I always put seaweed in my bolognese, and I've been told I make a pretty damn good bolognese sauce. So,
well, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
Adds a depth of flavour, and that's the beauty of adding wild food ingredients. There's a different depth to your cooking when you do that.
Absolutely, yeah. And so different to buying something out of the supermarket.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to some sea lettuce salad when I get back.
Yeah.
Before you dehydrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was eating some of the sea spaghetti as we were going along, and you were far too busy cutting loads of it and stuffing it into a bag. But I was actually chewing. It's just really lovely in the mouth, fresh.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's really good flavour.
The texture of it's fantastic. Mm. It's crunchy. It's flavoursome. And I could quite happily graze. I'm going to be doing more of that now, grazing amongst the rocks. But there are certain times when you shouldn't come foraging for seaweed, aren't there?
Yeah, you want to be really foraging at this time of year for seaweed. So in the early seasons of the year, and then leave it be, because it needs to replenish itself. You don't want to be coming in and cutting seaweed when it's trying to reproduce. So basically get out into, you know, March, April, early spring tides, and do your foraging then.
Brilliant. Well, Karen, thank you so much for my introduction to seaweed foraging. Okay. This is the first time I've actually done seaweed foraging. Well, so
there you go. Yes, and it's been great. A lovely morning.
We gathered about 7 different types of sea veg in all, and I had some sea lettuce salad that day after giving it a good wash several times to get the sand out. It was delicious. And the fresh sea spaghetti was a revelation. It was so good with just a simple garlic and olive oil sauce. Rekindling our relationship with the water and what lives in it is so important. And next time, I'll be talking with Iski Britton, author of an excellent new book all about that, called Ebb and Flow. But we're near the end of today's show. Remember, you can listen to our shows on all the main podcast platforms these days. And if you appreciate them, or if they've helped you, do help us spread the word by liking and sharing. You never know, it might just be what someone you know needs to hear. And that really is all for today. Join me here again for more Alchemy 101. Until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.